From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Gun violence strikes Congress. How will lawmakers respond? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Yesterday's attack on a Republican baseball practice was one of 155 shootings involving four or more people since the first of this year. That's almost one such incident every day. Congressman Steve Scalise is still in critical condition. Out of respect to him, Congress has canceled a hearing on bills that would ease regulations on firearm silencers and armor-piercing ammunition. Even Democrats who favor gun control aren't pushing it hard. Whatever happened to limitations on the Second Amendment, favored by public opinion? Later on today's Talking Point, is America's polarization leading to a kind of civil war or political divorce? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. A congressman is gunned down during baseball practice with three other people, just one of more than 150 mass shootings this year. Will bullets striking so close to home change anything on Capitol Hill? We'll get some answers. On today's Talking Point later, Americans are separating themselves from each other in many ways, culturally, politically, and geographically. Will that lead to a kind of civil war or something more complicated? First, this news update. Before he was fired, FBI Director James Comey told President Trump three times he was not under investigation. That was then. This is now. It's reported that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is looking for potential obstruction of justice. Ryan Goodman is a law professor at New York University. He's editor of Just Security. That's a blog about civil liberties and national security. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me with you.
What is the Washington Post reporting? That's where the story first broke, about the obstruction of justice investigation.
Well, it seems as though, according to the Washington Post report, that the special counsel, Mueller, has indeed opened an obstruction of justice investigation, which would mean that the president himself would be the target of that investigation.
And we know that because of the witnesses he's called?
It's a little unclear as to who the sources are because they are anonymous sources, but at the very least, the Washington Post is drawing an inference from the witnesses who are called. So the witnesses are three heads of the intelligence agencies, two sitting heads, and one who recently stepped down. And the information they have is whether or not the president, as otherwise reported in the news, called them to ask them to put pressure on FBI Director Comey at the time to drop the investigation.
And this is something they refused to discuss before the Senate Intelligence Committee in open hearing.
That's correct. But they also did say at the same time they would be willing to discuss with the special counsel.
Okay. So apparently that is going on. So what are the parameters of obstruction of justice? What would the president have to be convicted of?
So he would have to be convicted of trying to subvert or otherwise undermine an ongoing investigation, and there are two main ones that are at issue. The first is the investigation of Michael Flynn for probably, it sounds like, having made false statements or lies to the FBI about his phone call with the Russian ambassador, and that's where on Valentine's Day the president apparently told Comey or said that he hoped that he would drop that investigation. So that's one. And then the second big one is, why did the president fire Comey? As the president himself has said, now on two occasions, he did so to relieve pressure from the Russia investigation. And if that's the case, that would also be obstruction in that much broader, much bigger FBI investigation.
So the president has, to a certain extent, gotten himself into this situation by public statements he's made.
That's right. They're almost like public admissions. And the curious thing is that in most obstruction of justice cases, the hardest element to prove is intent. Why did the person take their actions? But the president himself, at least in the Russia investigation, the reason for firing Comey has been quite explicit.
Now, today, there have been a couple of Trump tweets. One is, you are witnessing the single greatest witch hunt, all in capitals, in American political history. And he also said they made up a phony conclusion with the Russians' story, found zero proof. Now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story. Nice. Does that help or hurt him?
I think it hurts him. I mean, it just doesn't, that's, none of that is going to persuade the special counsel. I don't know who it really convinces. And we have very reasonable people who have spoken about the case. I think it would take a gigantic leap of imagination to think that the FBI itself and the special counsel would do anything but follow the letter of the law in these cases. And, you know, one of the most important statements I've heard in recent times was by the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, who's been very sober-minded about all this, saying that that he has seen the evidence and that there's beyond circumstantial evidence of some connection between some Trump affiliates and the Russians during the campaign. That would be enough to at least proceed with an investigation. You know, we shouldn't jump to conclusions of what they'll ever find, but I don't think anybody reasonably looking at this would doubt somebody like Robert Mueller.
Is it Justice Department policy, though, not to indict a sitting president of the United States?
It's a great question. It's an open question, unsettled. It is the case that the Office of Legal Counsel has two opinions. One, the most recent one was in year 2000, where they conclude that under the Constitution, a sitting president is immune from criminal prosecution. So at the end of the day, all we might see is the special counsel recommending this to an impeachment proceeding. But that really is an unsettled question. The special prosecutor in the Nixon case actually did take the position that a sitting president could be criminally prosecuted.
And obstruction of justice was a count in the impeachments of both Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton.
Exactly. So there's a kind of an ample precedent for that.
Okay. So we don't know what's going to happen. Is this the sort of thing that just takes a very long time?
I think so. It's going to be painstaking. And it does seem as though there are a number of witnesses, such as the special counsel calling the heads of the intelligence agencies, and I think then there'll also be questions about the whole process that went into the decision to fire Comey, and there are people involved in that.
Okay, a lot of people involved, and obviously very high-ranking people, and also people who have closely held information in terms of national security in their heads. Ryan Goodman, it's good to talk with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Law professor at NYU and also the blog Just Security. In a moment, gun violence strikes Congress. How will lawmakers respond? This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Congressman Steve Scalise is still in critical condition after yesterday's shooting at the Republican baseball practice. Four people were hit in all, and that is the 155th such incident in the first 165 days of this year. Vice President Pence had this to say about tonight's charity baseball game, which will be played between Republicans and Democrats.
While there will always be those who seek to divide, who choose insult over insight, tonight, on a baseball field in our nation's capital, the world will see America is better than that.
David Hawkins, a senior editor at CQ's Roll Call. Good to have you on our program, as always.
Nice to be here, Warren.
So is this going to change anything when somebody so close, not so close, but in deeply involved in Congress, part of the leadership, so much so a part that he had guards at the baseball practice, is this going to change anything in terms of the attitude of Congress toward guns?
I really don't think so. I do not. I don't think it'll change their attitude toward gun control. I think that after a few days of sort of venting their pent-up emotional spleen. They will partisan reflexive partisanship will continue. I think that this, sadly, you know, we've seen this all too many times. 7 years ago, another member of Congress got shot in the head, and the opinion of Congress got worse, not better, and the vitriolic rhetoric got worse, not better, and gun control legislation went nowhere.
That was a Democrat, Gabby Giffords, in Arizona, and at that time, people on the let me first ask you what you mean by emotional spleen. Let's go there.
Well, I mean, so it's members of Congress are. At this point, they feel, I think, justifiably, their own feelings of personal vulnerability are heightened. I mean, this could not have been a sort of more innocent and bucolic setting. I mean, for whatever you think about the partisanship, they do play this game for charity. It's going to raise, it looks like, and I should confess that roll call, my company is one of the sponsors of this and actually helped create the game. It's going
to
create.
You don't have to confess. You can just take note of it.
I'll just take note of it.
Okay.
It's going to raise maybe $1 million for charity, and they were practicing at 6:30 in the morning on a suburban YMCA baseball field in the sunshine, and this happens. It made every member of Congress, I think, has some fear that they are vulnerable. As you noted a minute ago, the only reason this shooting was not worse is because Mr. Scalise, because he's the whip, There were some Capitol Police there watching the practice because he gets round-the-clock security. Had that not happened, shooting would have been much worse. So, yes, the emotional spleen is, you know, they feel vulnerable. They do feel a little bit like they bond together over this vulnerability in a bipartisan way, but that will fade.
Because the shooter, who is now deceased, reportedly spread anti-Trump material, anti-Republican material on the internet, and because he was a volunteer for Bernie Sanders last year, there are Republicans who are saying that it's violence on the left that's causing the problem, just as it was said in the case of Gabby Giffords that it was the other way around.
Absolutely true. There are a handful of Republicans who immediately went there. And you're right that although in the case of the guy who shot Congresswoman Giffords, he never quite explained his motives, and he was eventually judged unfit to stand trial and because of paranoid schizophrenia. But it's also the case that when Giffords was shot, she had just emerged from one of the closest congressional campaigns in the country, a campaign in which Sarah Palin, who was then a much more prominent member of the Republican elite than she is now, had actually sent out fundraising mailers with a picture of Ms. Giffords under a target site, surrounded by a target site graphic. So, yes, it is always going to be the case that that some will view this through a partisan lens. I think it's undeniable that this the fellow who was the shooter. Definitely, I mean, I've seen some of the social media screeds. He was undeniably antagonistic towards the Republicans. What we still don't know, however, is whether he happened upon this game by happenstance. What we do know is that he was actually living out of his car near the site of this baseball practice for several weeks, but apparently had never showed up there before yesterday morning, showed up there yesterday morning, asked a couple of congressmen as they were showing up for the practice, are these the Democrats practicing or the Republicans practicing? And only when the members of Congress said, we're the Republicans practicing, that the shooting began.
David Hawkins, again, a senior editor at CQ's Roll Call. Cliff Schechter is a Daily Beast columnist, also Democratic political and PR strategist. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We don't see Democrats coming forth in large numbers and saying, okay, it's finally time for gun control. We've got to get this dealt with, particularly given the number of mass shootings this year, 155 if you say that a mass shooting is when four people are struck by bullets. That's almost one every day. And yet the Democrats aren't coming forth and talking about gun control. Why not?
Well, likely because, they're looking at the landscape in Washington, realizing there's absolutely no chance that anything will pass. You have a Republican president, Donald Trump. The NRA spent about $30 million in electing him. You have A-plus rated Republican members of Congress who control Congress, and they blocked completely legitimate and very mainstream, as about moderate as it could be, legislation after 20 little children were massacred at their school. So I don't think there's really anything to make people think that that these guys are suddenly going to walk away from the NRA, who's their meal ticket, or walk away from their bent ideology, that, you know, that we can't solve this problem, even though it's been solved in every single other advanced democracy in the world. That's really what it is. You don't see Democrats saying it because there's no chance that the Republicans are going to do the right thing here.
Polls show that a large number of Americans want to see some form of gun control. Why is it then that, as you indicated, you think the NRA has such power? It doesn't spend all that much money, although it spends it very strategically.
Well, it's not actually not just the NRA. I mean, you've got right-wing media not regulating guns in any way is a matter of faith. So when you're somebody running in a conservative-drawn district, you know, they've gerrymandered these House districts as well as state legislative districts. You've got very conservative rural states people are running from. When you've got that kind of a situation, these guys fear primaries more. They fear what Breitbart might say about them. They fear what Rush Limbaugh might say about them. And Rush Limbaugh, Breitbart, many on Fox News like Sean Hannity, they're not tethered by the truth. They're willing to cite any bogus statistics and findings that they can. So they claim things like more guns make you safer and all these silly things that, again, every other country has found not to be true. And when they do that, so the people who might actually take a look at this honestly and say, this is, you know, we're here to actually serve our constituents and not, you know, the NRA or Rush Limbaugh, don't come to that conclusion because it's about keeping their seats. And there's really the answer. It's not just the NRA. It's the whole apparatus.
Cliff Schechter, once again, Democratic political strategist, also a columnist at the Daily Beast. David Kopel is a research director at the Independence Institute. That's an associate. He's an associate policy analyst also with the Cato Institute in Washington, and he's adjunct professor of advanced constitutional law at the University of Denver's Sturm College of Law. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
Are you taking a Republican point of view here, or are you taking a position more like the Cato Institute?
Well, I suppose the Cato Institute, which is nonpartisan, also the Independence Institute, which is named after the Declaration of Independence, which is also nonpartisan.
Okay. So what do you say to the idea that other democracies, comparable in many ways to the United States, have gun control laws and have guns, and don't have 150 mass shootings since the first of the year?
Well, I think the American people have elections, and we choose our leaders, and what the previous guest was talking about has certainly been offered as a possibility and soundly rejected by the American people over and over again. And if it weren't for the gun issue, Donald Trump wouldn't have won that last election, and we wouldn't have a Republican Senate, among other things. And they see that when you go down the road that the other guest was talking about, you end up at the bottom of the slippery slope in England, where people aren't even allowed to have guns in their own home for defensive if someone breaks in.
How was it that gun control elected Donald Trump?
Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, and the margins he won in that, and you know, not every voter votes on the gun issue, but as the other guest was saying, the NRA and the other pro-civil rights organizations are very good at communicating with people who are interested in that message and getting them to turn out.
You say gun control has been rejected, and yet polls show that a majority of Americans do want to have gun control legislation, and that's been true for a long time.
Well, that's false, and I've written an article on that in the journal Political Communication.
Okay.
It all depends on the question you ask. You can certainly frame any question you want that's going to get a yes, but there's a difference between how a question can be framed in a very attractive way versus what the gun ban lobbies actually promote. So that's why in Colorado, I represented almost all the state's sheriffs in a lawsuit against gun controls that were enacted because legislators thought the poll numbers were on their side, and it turned out not, and it cost the political party that did that, the Democrats, control of the state Senate.
Cliff Schechter, back to you. Isn't it true that a lot of law enforcement officers are, in fact, in favor of gun control? They've gotten together with Gabby Gifford and her husband, former astronaut, and advocated it.
Yeah, there are a lot in favor, and there's so many things that Mr. Capel said there that aren't true, I almost don't know where to begin.
Well, Bill, what are they? Go ahead.
Well, I'm happy to list them all. First of all, in Colorado, in the place where those two senators lost their seats in a low turnout special election, the Democrats then came back and won those seats right back during a regular election, including a member of Mayor Bloomberg's group, won one of those seats in favor of gun safety legislation. That's the first thing. The second thing, to make the claim that everything ends up like a slippery slope like England is ridiculous and not based on the facts. There are numerous countries, among them Canada, Switzerland, the Norway, and others that have put intelligent, common sense gun reforms in place and where people still do have gun ownership. The third thing is, when he says a majority of people don't support gun control, it's amazing how polls put out by people like Frank Luntz, a Republican, will find 90%+ of people in favor of background checks, will find 80%+ of people in favor of stopping those on the terror watch list from getting their hands on guns, making people report lost and stolen guns, and all sorts of common sense measures. It's when Mr. Capel and his friends, like John Lott, ask questions and lose surveys they suddenly can't find when they're looking them up and try to play with the numbers that we end up getting these dishonest facts. The vast majority of people have shown in numerous elections, Washington State, when people came out and voted.
Okay, wait a minute. Before you go any further, David Coppell, you have an opportunity to respond to all of that about Colorado, about the slippery slope, and about the polls as well.
Sure. And the point is, in those other countries that are their guest favors, people aren't allowed to own guns for self-defense. That's the core issue. Yeah, and yes, can you own a gun in Norway for hunting and things like that? Yeah, yes. But can you own a gun for self-defense? Can you carry a gun for self-defense? Absolutely not. And that is the difference. That's why America put a Second Amendment in its Constitution for a purpose, which was not hunting primarily, but it was for people to be able to protect themselves.
What about the polls, though? And we have Frank Luntz, who is a Republican pollster, turning out polls that show people favoring gun control, according to Cliff Schechter.
Oh, and when you say background checks, that's a concept. When you look at the bills that are actually pushed through, as in Washington State, by the gun ban lobby, it's a much harsher thing. For example, under the Washington law, if you're a firearm safety instructor, say teaching a hunter safety class, part of firearm safety is to be able to hand a gun from one person to another safely, which is you make sure the gun's unloaded, the action is open so that it can't fire, that the safety's on, those kind of things. And you need to teach your students to practice how to do that. But under the Washington law, that's a gun transfer, so you can't teach that in a safety class anymore, for students how to hand a firearm safely from one person to another, because under the Washington law, you have to go down to a gun store and have that transfer that might last 15 seconds processed as if it were a gun sale. So that's and if you ask people about that on the polls, they wouldn't agree with it. But yes, so there's a difference between abstract questions in polls and actual laws. And unfortunately, the people in Washington State got bamboozled by the massive spending of the Bloomberg lobby, and they thought they were voting for background checks on gun sales, but it turned out to be something that actually severely restricts safety training and other constructive things.
All right. We have money being spent on both sides. We have obviously very different points of view. Cliff Schechter, quickly, if you will, in those countries where guns are allowed, what about the issue that you can't carry them for self-defense?
Well, no. I mean, concealed carry is a whole different issue. And yeah, what again, your guest didn't tell you is before the 1980s in this country, in most states, you couldn't, either concealed carry was outlawed. In most towns, if you look back in the history of this country, there was a reason why, when you went into Tombstone, you had to check your guns before you went in, because people understood that if you went into cities and people were in bars drinking and gambling and doing all sorts of things like that, having guns led to more people getting shot and was actually a pretty bad idea. The Violence Policy Center has something on concealed carry killers, and they'll show you how many people who have these licenses who have to go through almost zero training can walk around and put our families in danger. So
okay, we've established the differences. They are familiar to us. So when it comes to gun control, we're going to continue this conversation. However, as we go to a break, and on our talking point later, are America's growing differences leading to a kind of civil war, or is it a political divorce? And what's the difference? To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren, only back with To The Point. Yesterday's shooting at the baseball practice of the Republican congressional leader, Steve Scalise, has raised questions again about gun control. And we have heard once again the differences that appear from one person to another on that issue. On the other hand, this was the 155th or 154th, depending on how you count, because there was another one in San Francisco yesterday, shooting involving four people just since the first of this year. Mark Fulman of Mother Jones, that's a liberal magazine, where he is a national affairs editor, has studied mass shootings since 2012, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike. Hi, Mark. It's good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, if you will, how this one resembles and is different from others that you've looked at, particularly given the kind of reaction we're hearing.
Well, I guess the first thing I would say in terms of how it resembles other cases is that it's complicated, and it's far more complex than I think, you know, the immediate debate and outcry reflects. I mean, you know, we're living in a time of heightened emotions and extreme partisan politics. And I think, you know, we saw how that fed into the equation yesterday. The question of politics, the role of politics in this shooting is an interesting one, but I don't think it's a simple one. You know, people quickly jumped onto all of the, you know, quickly emerging evidence about the perpetrators' political views as expressed on social media and his apparent role volunteering on the Bernie Sanders campaign. But at the end of the day, you know, understanding why people go out and commit these attacks is a complicated question. And often the debate just sails right past that immediately. I mean, I think, you know, the first segment you had on today's show, you know, we're back hearing the same gun control debate over and over that we've heard for years and years. And I think that does little to contribute to a serious discussion about how we go about trying to prevent these attacks from happening.
Well, let's have it. What sort of efforts could we make that we're not making?
Well, I think better research, more data, you know, that's something I've worked on through journalism. But, you know, as you know, for many years, research into gun violence has been suppressed, largely due to the politics of it and the successful lobbying work of the gun lobby in Congress to quash government funding for studying this issue. And, you know, we have enough data to know that gun violence is a serious societal issue. Most experts in public health agree it's a serious public health crisis in this country. We did a study on the economic impact a couple years ago at Mother Jones. It's upwards of $289 billion a year in economic impact. So I think, you know, looking at the all kinds of data around gun violence, and not just with mass shootings, of course, which are really a fraction of the gun violence problem in the United States, really beginning to drill down on the kinds of things that contribute to people committing gun violence is a place to start. I don't think we still have nearly enough of that work going on to try to solve this problem.
Let me go back to David Hawkins, our first guest, who needs to leave us soon, senior editor at CQ's Roll Call. What about the quashing of research data and research by the federal government? Is Mark Fulman right? Has that been done?
He absolutely is right. This has been a prohibition in law for, I think, a couple of decades. I don't remember exactly since when. It will be interesting to see if even that much of the debate is revived this year. Usually this prohibition that we're talking about is attached to a spending bill. They're just starting to talk about spending bills in Congress this spring. So it is one small way in which the debate could be revived. It'll be interesting to see. By the way, while we were During the break, I received a release from the FBI and the U.S. Capitol Police that does answer one mystery about the guns used yesterday, a 9mm handgun and a 7.62 caliber rifle. The ATF has conducted traces on both weapons, and it says they're both purchased from federal firearms licenses, and the FBI and the Capitol Police says no evidence to suggest the purchases were not lawful. So that at least puts a fine point on the fact that Mr. Hodgkinson seems to have obtained these guns legally.
Hodgkinson, the man who was, by the testimony of eyewitnesses, was the shooter. David Hawkins, great to have you with us, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Warren. Bye-bye.
Cliff Schechter, back to you, our Democrat. Do you know, is there any effort on the part of Democrats to propose that there be more federal research into gun violence?
Oh, sure. I mean, look, Democrats have wanted to do this. There would be more research for years. The former Republican congressman who used to do the NRA's bidding, the late Jay Dickey, apologized for what he did in terms of blocking research. You know, more science and more research, when you know you're right, you want more of that out there. And the independent research that's been done, that was done before the ban, before the CDC was blocked from doing it, that's been done by independent groups, comes to the same conclusion. So, you know, one needs to ask themselves, why is the NRA so determined to block this research? It's a pretty simple answer, because it won't come out the way they want it to.
David, don't go back to David Kopel on this with the Cato Foundation. What do you say to that? Should there be more research?
Cato Institute, to be technical. There's never been a federal ban on gun research, and your guests don't know what they're talking about. Since the late 1990s, there have been appropriations riders relevant to the Centers for Disease Control, and then later expanded to the Department of Health and Human Services in general, that say you can't use federal funds to advocate for gun control. There's never been a ban on research on the gun issue. And, in fact, one of the things President Obama did after Newtown with all his executive actions in 2013 was to encourage additional federal research on the topic because, of course, and that was completely lawful what he did because these appropriations riders only applied by their own terms to advocacy of gun control and not to research on the gun issue. And certainly you don't need the federal government's not the only research organization in this country. For example, Michael Bloomberg has put in tens of millions of dollars to Johns Hopkins to promote anti-gun research, as he has every right to do, to spend his money as he wants. And the amount of social science research going on about guns is higher than ever, much higher than it was in the early 1990s, when there were no appropriations restrictions on gun control advocacy by federal researchers.
Okay, David Hawkins at Roll Call has left us, but we still have Mark Fullman, again, who has studied this at some length for Mother Jones Magazine. Here we're hearing that the research that is prohibited is advocacy research, and he's also indicating that the research sponsored by former Mayor Bloomberg is designed to be anti-gun. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I mean, this is also a tired debate of semantics, largely, you know, very well documented how federal funding has and hasn't worked around this issue. But let's also talk about what we know from data that we do have. I mean, the database that I've built over the last 5 years looking at public mass shootings in depth, it's up to 90 cases now. And in more than 80% of these attacks over the last 35 years, the perpetrators have used legally obtained firearms. As happened yesterday. And I think, you know, that raises a very clear and simple policy question. How are people like this possessing firearms? You know, the debate can depart from that. There's plenty of evidence that, you know, the way that gun regulations work, you can look at it on the state level too, that, you know, states that have less restrictive gun laws have larger per capita costs of gun violence. It's something else we've documented in a deep investigation at Mother Jones and so on and so forth. So, you know, I think that often we still see the political debate around gun violence is just completely mired in this sort of ideological back and forth and semantic spin. But when you look at data, there's a much different picture to grapple with. And it's a complicated problem, no doubt, but it has to be a data-driven discussion or we're never going to get anywhere, and we'll continue to see these kinds of attacks like we saw again yesterday, not just in Washington, D.C. or in Virginia, but also in San Francisco.
San Francisco, where a UPS employee shot up some of his former colleagues and then killed himself. You used the phrase.
That's right. And I should just point out, too, that attack in San Francisco yesterday was the fourth workplace mass shooting in the past month. And, you know, these attacks aren't getting as much attention as they used to. I think the country is very focused on what's going on in national politics with good reason. But this problem is persistent and has escalated in recent years as well.
You use the phrase people like this to refer to the shooter. What do you mean by people like this? And how would it have been possible to prevent this man from getting a gun? He, I don't think, has a violent past. I may not be correct about that, but I guess he had domestic violence in his past. Is that something that ought to be used to prohibit people from having guns?
Well, you raise an excellent question, and it's an exceedingly difficult question to answer. There is no profile for a mass shooter. People who've studied this problem for decades now, threat assessment experts who work in this field to try to prevent these attacks, all agree there's no way you can profile people and predict who's going to carry out this crime. But there is growing research, growing data, as they continue to study this problem, that shows different correlations that start to give us a sense of some of the problems that might point to someone headed down what they call the pathway to violence. And domestic abuse is absolutely one of them. There's a strong correlation of that in these cases, including this perpetrator yesterday who had a long history of domestic abuse. Substance abuse figures in at times. There's a whole range of behavioral patterns that are now studied in terms of trying to anticipate somebody who might be considering carrying out an attack like this and intervening constructively. There's a part of that conversation that then gets into access to weapons. I mean, that's obviously a crucial part of this equation. You can't carry out a mass shooting if you don't have a weapon.
Okay.
But, you know, the weapon alone is not the cause or the sole part of the solution. It's a much more complex equation trying to identify and stop an individual from doing this.
All right, David Kopel with the Cato Institute. Given the statistics we just heard and the fact that there are so many of these and have been so many just since the first of this year, is this something we just have to live with?
No, and I think we need to continue the progress we've made in the last quarter century. The homicide rate in this country has been cut by over half, and the gun homicide.
Yeah, but we're talking about these mass shootings. And
well, I'm talking about homicides, including homicides perpetrated by guns. And I'm saying we've cut, and you can have those committed one at a time, or three at a time, or whatever. The victims are all equally dead. We've cut homicides and gun homicides in this country by over half in the last quarter century. That's really important progress. We've now got the gun homicide rate down to the level it was in the early 60s.
How has that happened?
The big crime surge began. Well, in greater incarceration of criminals, improvements in gun laws in several ways. As the guest was talking about, domestic violence is absolutely associated with later committing violence against non-domestic people. So since the 1990s, anybody who's convicted of even a misdemeanor act of domestic violence loses their right to own a gun.
So is that a form of gun control that you approve of then?
Yes, and that's it's a very harsh law. It's the only law. The Second Amendment's the only thing you can lose it forever by a single one conviction of a misdemeanor.
Okay, so Cliff Schechter, back to you, our Democratic strategist. What about that? If you can lose it for domestic violence, what else should you be able to lose it for?
Well, I mean, look, there's all sorts of loopholes to that. Domestic violence, is the definition of that is if you cohabitated with somebody, had a child with them, or have been married to them. So there's all sorts of boyfriends who still are able to get access to weaponry for misdemeanor violations. It really just comes down to this. You have to decide as a society. Australia did this in 1996 after their Port Arthur massacre. They passed a series of laws, and gun homicides went down 80% and or 50%, excuse me, gun suicides 80%. You need to decide, are the rights of the people who don't want to be shot, do we have the same rights as anybody who wants to go and buy a gun? And in this particular case with the gentleman you're talking about, he had shot across his neighbor's backyards with a gun. He committed domestic violence in a country that valued the lives of the rest of the people and not a trumped up version of the Second Amendment that was ahistoric and did not exist before the 1980s, which is that there's some individual right. That we would put the right, we would look at the rest of the Constitution and say domestic tranquility, you know, general welfare, parts of the Constitution, that our lives are as important, if not more important, than people
okay.
who have proven themselves to be too violent to have guns.
So, Mark Fulman with Mother Jones, what about the claim by David Kopel that the homicides have, in fact, been drastically reduced, cut by half, while we still have guns around? What does that say to you?
Well, the longer-term trends in violent crime are a function of many factors in our society. But I guess the response to that in the context of these mass shootings that we keep seeing would be, I guess, the question, you know, how many mass shootings is too many mass shootings? You know, the number of these public attacks has gone up. That I've done a lot of work to document that over the last several years, gathering data and analyzing these cases. And my database of mass shootings at Mother Jones was independently corroborated by a study from the FBI and from the Harvard School of Public Health, finding the same conclusion in terms of frequency, which is that the rate of these attacks has tripled in frequency in the last handful of years. So that's a problem that we need to deal with.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all. We're certainly not going to resolve this issue on this program, but we have, I think, illuminated the differences once again. Some of these things are familiar, some of them aren't. And I want to thank you all very much for participating. Mark Fulman, again, is National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones. David Kopel is with the Cato Institute, where he's an Associate Policy Analyst. He's also a Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Denver. Cliff Schechter is a Daily Beast columnist and a Democratic political and public relations strategist. David Hawkins, our earlier guest, is senior editor at CQ Roll Call. Thank you all very much for being on our program. How can Americans best live with their differences? This is To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Allen here with today's talking point. The polarization of America is so well established that, quote, the only real debate is over the nature of our cultural, political, and religious conflict, close quote. That's from David French, who's a columnist for the Conservative National Review. Some commentators are calling this a cold civil war. David French says it's something different. David French, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You call it a divorce. What do you mean?
Yeah, I think heading. The trends are pointing us towards a divorce in the sense of a literal separation. If you look at this trends, not just in political polarization that we talk about all the time, and political polarization is high, and it's the worst kind of polarization. It's a negative polarization where you are more likely to be, say, a Republican because you hate Democrats than because you necessarily love Republican ideas, and vice versa. But we also have a serious case of geographic sorting going on. We tend to live with people of like mind. The number of landslide counties, those counties that go for one side by 20 points or more, has dramatically increased, and it's at an all-time high since we've been measuring it. Also, you know, if you're talking about religious habits, if you look at the map of church attendance in the United States, every single state that has a below average church attendance was a blue state. Every single state that had the highest levels or above average levels was a red state. And even going into television watching habits, and this is one thing that was really interesting to me, is if you overlay some maps of TV shows, take, for example, one of my favorites, Game of Thrones. I'm a conservative American living in a red America, and very few people around me watch Game of Thrones, much to my chagrin, but heavily that the TV show's audience have heavily clustered in sort of the Northeast and West Coast city centers. And so we're just living increasingly separate lives.
If you're living in a Game of Thrones, if you're conducting yourself by watching Game of Thrones and living in a different community, whatever happened to the idea of geographical separation?
Well, you know, there are obviously exceptions to the rule. There are people who are sort of square pegs and round holes in any given community in the U.S. But what we have is a situation where people aren't just not able to understand other people's points of view. They're increasingly not even able to understand other people's ways of living, their mores, their manners, their mannerisms. That's a troubling trend and a troubling change, and it's one that I think, unless it's arrested, unless it's a trend that can be slowed or stopped or reversed, could have some even more profound consequences for polarization down the road.
What do some of your neighbors have against Game of Thrones?
Well, they haven't seen it to have anything against it, and that's kind of the point. Is it's not even that people are considering different forms of culture and rejecting it. They're just not even considering it at all. It's just not something on their radar screen.
Back to politics, you were not a Trump supporter, but you are living amongst a lot of people who are Trump supporters. Do you have conversations about that with one another? And if so, what are they like?
Let me put it this way. I have so many conversations about that. I wish I could have fewer. I've sort of erected at my church a no conversations about Trump rule when people are approaching me after Sunday school. Look, I've never in my adult life seen political tensions run so high. And what that means is for many people in this community, I'm the only person who opposed Trump that they know. And so, I guess to their credit, they're eager to seek out and say, well, what do you think now? What do you think now? What are your thoughts now? It's an interesting phenomenon that we're living in communities where finding someone who didn't support your chosen candidate is getting increasingly difficult. I mean, let's look at, say, for example, in Manhattan or Brooklyn, you're going to have percentages of people who voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump that rival or sometimes even surpass the percentages, say, of white evangelicals who voted for Donald Trump. And so you, in other words, have entire cities that have less ideological diversity than, say, a big evangelical megachurch. And that's a problem when it comes to just the very basic fact of understanding opposing points of view.
In the big metropolitan areas, though, isn't there a certain amount of intermingling? You talked about landslide counties. To some extent, that's a factor of gerrymandering by the legislature in order to make sure they collect certain voters in certain places. I know in Los Angeles, for example, people I know who are liberals find, to their surprise, that they are living close to people who are Trump supporters.
Yeah, I think that, you live more on top of each other in cities, but that's not necessarily the case that you intermingle with them in a social setting. One of the more surprising things to me, so I grew up in rural Kentucky, and when I went to law school, I encountered a number of my fellow classmates who'd never had any kind of serious personal, meaningful personal relationship with a conservative in their lives. And that's not to say that there weren't conservatives who attended school with them or there weren't conservatives who maybe lived down the block from them, but they weren't in their social circles. And that's part of the sorting that's happening in this country. And it's one of the reasons why we tend to gravitate more to extremes. And it's one of the reasons why we tend to be completely unable to even understand opposing points of view.
Do you, living in Trump country as you do, try to stay in touch with those law school colleagues who had never met anybody like you before?
Yeah, absolutely. I have the benefit that while I have friends from all over the political spectrum, we're united by the fact that we love baseball. And so I've been for the last 25 years part of a fantasy baseball league. And so I have great friendships with people who are very different from me ideologically. In fact, one of my very good friends, a person I respect and a great deal, is the judge who in Maryland who ruled against the Trump travel ban. I respect the heck out of him. I disagree with that ruling, but I respect the heck out of him. And maintaining those friendships has been one of the most important and enriching aspects of my life. Not everybody gets the chance to do that, but everybody does at least have the opportunity to reach out in their own reading and their own study and read the best expressions of opposing points of view. If you may live in a neighborhood where everyone agrees with you or attend a church where everyone agrees with you, but that's no reason to confine your reading to those outlets or to those people who only agree with you. So it's incredibly important to reach out and read the best of what the other side has to say.
So Game of Thrones is an example of differences. Baseball is an example of similarities. Let's get back to the issue of divorce and how do you apply it when we have those differences?
Well, you know, I think one of the points that I was making was that what we have is sort of this is happening by the natural process of people matching with each other. This is a concept that Tyler Cowen talks about in his really interesting book, The Complacent Class, where people, it's just human nature to want to live and work and associate with people of like mind, people who agree with you, people who appreciate where you're coming from. And when you combine that with technology and you combine that with mobility, it's a lot easier to form these sort of self-sustaining communities, whether actually geographically, which is occurring, or online, which is occurring. And so this is kind of something that's happening just naturally. There's going to have to be an external change or some sort of external unforeseen cultural shift for us to move back in a direction of unification. And that's why I talk not so much civil war. Civil war means one side trying to forcibly dominate and keep the other one in the body politic, whereas a divorce, for example, is two parties drifting apart and slowly growing to not only dislike each other, but not even want to be around each other.
So we have federalism in this country. Is that what we're liable to see, do you think? Geographical separation of a more general and deep kind than we have now? And we have about 20 seconds to answer the question.
I hope so. Federalism is a way that you can maintain deep convictions at the same time that you maintain unity. In other words, let California be California, let Tennessee be Tennessee, so long as we protect everyone's fundamental constitutional rights. I think that's a way through this, okay. So long as people will surrender their desire to control others.
David French, senior writer at National Review, conservative publication, author of We're Not in a Civil War, But We Are Drifting Toward Divorce. Thanks a lot for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast at a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.